This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Just making sure that we have women around the table is really important. And as I say, important that you have grassroots women represented too. That they are often the ones that are, you know, out there getting water for the communities, supporting the communities, and they're seeing the very real impacts. When you have floods, when you have droughts, when you have extreme weather events, women taking care of children have very specific preoccupations and challenges, and we need to be making sure that they're part of the conversation.
Good afternoon, it's Feminist Fridays. I'm Tina Camellia. You've just heard Canada's Minister of Environment and Climate Change, Catherine McKenna, speaking on Gender Day at the 23rd Conference of the Parties to the UN Climate Change Convention in Bonn, Germany. If you're wondering why climate change is a gender issue, I hope I'll be able to address that this hour. At COP23, which ran from the 6th to the 17th of November, Gender Day was observed on the 14th of November, a day dedicated to highlighting gender issues in climate change, but also to mark progress in women-centred climate action. Here's Senior Advisor of the IUCN Gender Programme, also a Costa Rican delegate, Lorena Aguilar, giving a statement before the Gender Action Plan went into the main plenary.
Today, we celebrate the first Gender Action Plan for the UNFCCC. Today, we're making history. Gender issues, for us country from the South, is not a fashion or being politically correct. For us, women and men from the South, closing the gender gaps, being gender responsive is a matter of life and death. We are 7.6 billion people in the world. Half of this population are women. It would be somehow unbelievable to leave this power outside the solutions for climate change. We women are strong agents of change. This gender action plan will allow us to play an active role in the biggest threat this world has ever faced. Costa Rica, on behalf of Ireland, would like to thank the parties that make this historical moment possible. Thank you very much.
By the closing of COP23, the parties to the convention accepted the Gender Action Plan that was agreed upon at last year's COP in Morocco. The plan, as implied by its acronym GAP, aims to close the gender gap in climate activities. When it comes to climate change, there are many areas where this gender gap can be seen, but today we'll focus on land, specifically the desertification of land. In many developing countries, the burden still lies on the women to support their families and meet basic needs such as food, water and wood. However, crop failures, water scarcity and migration of traditional crops are on the rise. Globally, more than a third of land is degraded, most of it happening only in the last two decades, while current land management practices contribute to 25% of global greenhouse gas emissions, affecting the livelihood of up to 2.9 billion people worldwide.
You have different cases, depending whether you are in West Africa or the rest of Africa. But in West Africa, when the men have left the village because they could not make a living anymore, they left the women and the children, and the land got worse than what it was, much worse. And the reason is that when you speak to those women there in the village, they say, no, we will not look after the land because anything we product, then anyone in the village can come and claim it because women have no rights on the land. And so clearly it allows us to put the question of the land rights again on the table. And this is a poison. This is certainly the question of land rights is one of the issues which has caused the most desertification and land degradation. Because if land belongs to nobody, then nobody wants to take care of it. Full stop. It's like for everything else. And so, of course, when we talk about those gender issues, we like always to show the nice story of how the women are doing much more. And it's true in many cases. But in certain cases, it has caused the situation in which they have been left without the right coming with has worsened the conditions. And we usually, when we talk gender issue, we usually associate it with rights issue, which go, by the way, beyond just the land rights. There are all kinds of other rights that women have been deprived, which then has also economic consequences. We like also, for example, in terms of migration, to give the following numbers, which actually came out of a study made by the British Ministry of Defence, showing that by 2045, there will be 130 million people migrating because of desertification, not climate change, desertification. Among those 135 million, 60 million will come from south of Sahel to either North Africa or Europe. So if today we cannot manage 1 million, this is going to be a big issue. And that is also what has triggered the fact that we have come with a strong gender issue.
For a little bit more background on this, let's take a visit to one of the side events at the COP, a session from the Agriculture Advantage series, The Gender Advantage, where Ilaria Firmian of the International Fund for Agricultural Development gave the first presentation, stating that the gender advantage in agriculture is already widely documented. According to her, a research by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, shows that if women were given access to the same resources as men, agricultural output in developing countries could increase, while the number of hungry people could be significantly reduced.
I think we are all aware of the gender advantage in agriculture. According to FAO, for example, we know that if women were given access to the same resources as men, the agricultural output in developing countries could increase by up to 4%. Always according to FAO, we know that if we were able to respond to gender needs around adaptation, we could reduce the number of hungry people in the world by 12 to 17%. And more in terms of project impacts, I heard recently a study from CARE, where a study on land recuperation, where we could see that if women were given the lead on the process, they could do the same work as done by men leading the process with only 18% of the cost.
Antonia Raw of the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere CARE also spoke at the session on how the gender dynamics in agriculture are quickly changing.
The dynamics are very much changing. We see that in a lot of countries, women are about 43% of the agriculture labor force, and in some countries it's growing because there are a lot of these dynamics. One thing I didn't mention, which is sort of mission critical for doing any kind of gender equality and women's empowerment work, is the engagement of men and boys, so that you're working with not just women, but also with the men and boys in the community to talk about dynamics at all different levels, so that if there is out-migration by men to find work in cities, there's an understanding of what that means for women when they're left behind. It's also important then that all of this work sit in the context of a more comprehensive approach so that it isn't just about agriculture. It's also about diversifying a family's livelihood. It's about ensuring that they aren't just dependent on agriculture so that there are other options, perhaps at a community level, other than migration, if the head of the household doesn't want to migrate. And the work I'd done on migration was an 8-country study where we looked at changing rainfall patterns, the impact of food security, and then resulting human mobility. And there was very much an awareness that people don't always want to migrate. They do because they don't have other options.
And now we come back to Monique for her thoughts.
As you know, for a long time, this convention and the subject we are treated have been considered as being, let's say, second zone type of subject, or, you know, not global enough to interest the global community. But it is, I have to say, changing. Even in the climate arena, if, for example, you look at the INDC, that countries have submitted, more than 140 countries have said that land was part of their solution or their problem, depending on how you want to look at it, in terms of climate change. Also, the subject in itself, the land issue, is becoming a global issue on different fronts. it's not just only the poor in our country, somewhere else, which are suffering from drought, for example. I mean, France this summer has known a very big drought and is still keeping on in the south of France. Countries like Canada has known drought. So it is a subject which is, unfortunately, because of the climate change, starting to impact more and more countries. U.S. During the last few years have known major drought in California and other regions. But also, it is becoming a global problem because the social and political consequences of major drought are going out of their borders today. And if you take, for example, the illegal migration to Europe, it's interesting to note that 100% of the illegal migrants are coming from drylands. So then you can, of course, say it has nothing to do with that. In this country, it's the political problem. In this country, it is something else. But if I just take numbers as they come, this is what we see as numbers. So on one hand, the migration. On the other hand, the radicalism. In Africa, you have here desertification. Those were food riots the same year. And that's Al-Qaeda Africa. So you can also say that it has nothing to do, doesn't matter. Those are the figures as they come out of the reality. And so there are a certain number of things which now make people understand that somehow maybe we have underestimate what is happening in vulnerable places of the world when the only asset of the people is the land, and that the land does not give them anything anymore.
Up next, we'll find out more on food security from Monique Barbout, Executive Director of the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Although people are changing their mind, they are not changing it that much. It's not a glamorous subject. It is always difficult, even when you give numbers and all that, to make the point that this is an important subject that people are overlooking. I have given you the dramatic type of things, but what is going to be food security in 50 years? Who is going to ensure the food security of the world? What are the countries which are going to produce enough food for their population? Where do they will the others need to buy it? All that belongs to the same issue. And that one, for example, is linked to another question, which is the question of land grabbing. Because some people are starting to think that, yes, where they are producing today, they will not be in a position to produce. And so they are buying land in conditions that are very dark, I would say. In 20 years from now, people who have the land will be the one who will make the price of the food.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Tina Camilla. We've been talking with Monique Barbout, Executive Director of the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification, about the intersections between climate change, land degradation, and gender. As we found out in the first part of the show, women are disproportionately reliant on land-based resources, all the while having relatively poorer security over their rights to these resources. Let's pick up where we left off. Food security. As alluded by the earlier speakers, food security is tightly linked with land use.
You know, I like to tell the story again in its globality. So let's go like that. In 2050, we will be 10 billion people. To feed 10 billion people, you need to increase food production by 75%. To increase food production by 75%, you need, from now to 2050, to put 4 million hectares of land every year in production, new land. Today, where do we take those 4 million hectares every year? We take them from forests and wetlands mainly. At the same time, on this planet, you have 2 billion hectares of degraded land, among which 500 million are abandoned agricultural land in the world. If we were to restore 300 million hectares out of those 2 billion, you would ensure food security by 2050. You will give a living to the 500 million small farms existing in the world, which feeds directly 2 billion people. And you would, by just restoring 300 million hectares, close the gap in climate change of one-third between what are the emissions today of CO2 and what it will take to be at the 2 degrees. One-third of it could be covered just by a land rehabilitation activity. So it's a very powerful measure in all kind of fronts. And my question is why we are not more interested into that discussion in the climate agenda. So I have, of course, my own thinking about that, which is maybe not politically correct, but I will give it to you. The problem is that behind my speech, there is no lobby. I have nothing to sell. To restore land is mainly labor. You don't need big technology. You don't need, billions and billions of transfers. And so, of course, it's not, again, glamorous enough, and it's not business-oriented enough as such. There was another reason why the climate people didn't want too much to touch it, which is now starting to change a little bit. One of the reasons they didn't want to touch it so much was that many of the negotiators told me that, look, if you put that item as it is on the agenda, then it is not going to give big wheels for countries to agree to change, for example, the energy pattern. Because they will then say, oh, but then there is an easy solution with the land, so why should we change our energy patterns? But now, because most of the countries understand that the 2 degrees are going to be difficult, that's the least we can say, to attain, so the soil carbon sequestration is starting to gain some interest. At the same time, I wanted to say that the land issue is actually could be a very positive agenda because land can be restored anywhere. Of course, then it's a question of price, but in most of the degraded land that we know, for less than $300 the hectares, you can restore the land.
Drought, which is also closely linked with land degradation. You probably still remember the 2014 water crisis that lasted from February to August in Selangor. Notwithstanding the political deadlock in water concessionaire negotiations, the cause is also attributed to the hot and dry period that began earlier that year. It was the worst drought in Malaysia since the 1998 Klang Valley crisis following the El Nino phenomenon that drained major reservoir dams in the area.
And this is something which is appalling me, I have to say, is that every single year, people die more of drought than of any other environmental cause. You can have the worst typhoon of the year. It is not the number of what people die of drought even that same year. This year, in 2017, UN Secretary General has declared that it was the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II in the Horn of Africa because 25 million people have been left without being able to feed themselves. It didn't make a line in most of the newspapers of the world, not a line, 25 million people. And so clearly there is a disconnect for me between what is the subject, how it is treated, and the way that people look at it. And so that's why for me it's also important to be able to talk to people like you.
Okay, so we're talking. But what exactly is the UNCCD doing about the droughts?
We have started, and it's the drought of this year, we prompted me to propose the program, a drought preparedness initiative. You know, I was telling you that drought is killing more people than any other environmental cause. Do you know how many countries in the world have a drought preparedness system? 3. US, Australia, and Israel. Of course, a drought preparedness system is not going to impeach a drought, huh? But it can mitigate many of the effects. We have now the resources to go for a first stage, and we will be helping 40 countries to come with a full system of drought preparedness, I would say based very much on the American model. It is not an early warning system. It's WMO to do those kind of things. The question we are asking is, when you see what has happened this year, I mean, WMO has warned everyone that El Nino was going to be very strong. So we knew almost 4 or 5 months in advance that drought was going to be hard. What do you do when you know it? Nothing. When it starts to hit, then the Ministry of Agriculture takes a measure here. Yeah. The Ministry of I don't know what, water takes a measure there. And what we're saying, and the American model, for example, which is a very, by the way, top-down approach. Yeah. On that, it has to be top-down. Last year, before Obama left, one of the last things he did was to sign what we call the drought decree. Once it is signed by the president, then everybody in the chain knows that there is something that they have to do. It means the Ministry of Agriculture knows that already, for example, he has to start to see how he's going to divide the water between the pastures and the farmers, that he needs to tell the farmers, please don't go with that crop this year because that's not going to be sustainable. The Minister of Information starts to say to TV and radio, please go with XYZ message from that day and how it is. The Minister of Energy is going to take a certain number of measures also to make sure that if, for example, you have hydraulic system, they don't fall apart. There are all kinds of things. So, of course, at the end, the drought is going to come. But what it is that you have prepared and protect is what you have prepared and protect. And in every country, you have bits of that. I mean, I'm not saying it's completely new, but what there is not is one chain of command, which as soon as it is said, fluff. You know, it's not people starting to think, but what am I going to do now? You understand? You have a system and you go. It's your machine which is going. So then the implementation can be bottom-up, but the trigger has to be top-down.
That is just one of the few initiatives by the UNCCD to address land degradation. Another one is called land degradation neutrality.
To make it short, every year we destroy 12 million hectares of land. The land degradation neutrality is if we destroy 12 million, just in order not to increase the 2 billion hectares of already degraded and destroyed land, we need to restore 12 million hectares. It is an SDG now, it's SDG 15. And so the idea is to arrive to that neutrality by 2030, in 15 years, to make sure that we are restoring as much, at least, as what we are destroying for all kind of needs and land use. I'm very proud to say that this convention, and I think it is a unique case today, has a clear objective, land degradation neutrality, as indicators which are measurable, which are land cover, land productivity, and soil carbon, and as a route for implementation. Today, we are now in this convention on the implementation phase. And how do we go for implementation? We have helped all the countries which wanted to do the land degradation neutrality target setting. Today, 115 countries have subscribed to that. 50 have finished the exercise. The rest will be finishing this year. We are helping them to identify hotspots which are in need of action. And we have committed to help them go from this hotspot to write what we call transformative project, but a bankable project. So it's not that we just help them to get a target like exists so many.
But while Malaysia is not part of this target-setting program, we have implemented another UNFCCC-led program, RED Plus, or the Reduction of Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation Initiative. The initiative saw 97.5 million tons of carbon dioxide avoided for the period of 2006 through 2010 through improved forest management in Malaysia. She reminds us.
You know, we are a convention. We are not an implementing entity. I'm not UNDP. You know? The idea for us is to show the route, to show how things can be done, that it has benefit, that there is a business model, that we are not just talking utopia. But once the things are en route, there is no reason why we, as the convention, should stay active. We have done our job then, you know? And then it's to all the UNDP and the World Bank of this world to take it. We're ready to help. I have a right team who is capable to think those new models. We try. And when we have a machine which works, then we make sure that the machine is taken.
So what other machines do UNCCD have?
So it is the first report, which is made on the land issue. It is built a little bit on the model of the Human Development Report. So the idea is that we try to have one every 4 years, which is many topics of land issues, which are chosen by a group of scientific people, but don't think of hard science only. They are economists and other kind of sociologists, but with also a modelization and a mapping of all the land issues which has been made for that. We are starting to work now on the second edition, which will come in 2 or 3 years from now on. But please have a look at that. It is clearly the most complete information that you can get today on land issue on very objective basis. And I am very proud to announce that we have launched and the first closing of the biggest impact fund of the world, if you accept energy fund. Those are bigger, but if you put out the energy fund, we have launched what we call the LDN fund, which the first closing will be in Paris in 2 weeks at the Macron summit, a fund which is managed by Natixis. It is a public-private fund. We hope to have, by beginning of next year, about 300 million of capitalization in that fund. And it is the only fund at this scale linked to the question of land in the world. Investors have always been very difficult to convince to do. And final, the 3S initiative for sustainability, stability and security. This one, for the time being, is turned towards Africa. It is an innovative way to look at the question of land migration and those subjects. We are developing a program by which we are helping migrants on the return or migrants which are in camps to go back to their country, and we have agreement with those countries. We help them by actually agreeing to give them a salary for 3 years, the time by which the land is going to become productive again. Because if you don't pay them and say, here, you just get a piece of land, you know, that's not feeding them. And the idea behind this program is to rehabilitate 10 million hectares and create 2 million jobs. And we think that this model could be replicated elsewhere.
But more importantly,
thanks to actually the work of Wagaki, we have now come out with a gender policy framework, which is clearly the most advanced framework inside the conventions and which we will apply, in particular in all the transformative projects.
You've been listening to Executive Director of the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification, Monique Barbeau, about climate change and land degradation. And before I let you go, I'll leave you with one more gem from her.
If you have a cancer and at the same time you have a flu, you are going to treat first your cancer, okay? And the flu, either you do with it or it comes after. It's a little bit the same. The cancer today is the climate change and how you mitigate it. So, of course, all the ways to come down with the emissions are maybe not the most precious one of the world and the most glamorous and whatever. But do you have the choice? I believe that in a world where you have a population growing the speed as it is growing today and a food demand which is increasing the way that we see it increase, clearly we need to manage scarcity. Everybody has to play its role.
This is Feminist Fridays. I'm Tina Camilla, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.